You ain't heard about Moto Casino? Moto has real Vegas slots. Any game you can find on the floor in Vegas, you can play it on Moto. I like my slots hot. Moto's free to play, like food stamps. In line at the grocery store, at a funeral, in traffic. Keep your eyes on the road. Hop on Moto Casino. Moto Casino got jackpots that are bigger than my belly. Moto, America's hottest free-to-play social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today. Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
In the summer of 1999, 46-year-old Maria Bozzi, a Romanian immigrant living in the United Kingdom, met and married a man after a whirlwind romance. Within months, she would move to the United States to live with him. And soon after, she would disappear. This is her story.
Hi, I'm Vanessa.
And I'm Amy.
And you're listening to She Goes by Jane.
At the end of this episode and every episode, we will be joined by a special guest who will read an original poem by Amy Baker about the women we're featuring.
This week, we are joined by Anne Purvue.
Hi, Vanessa.
Hi, Amy.
Vanessa, this is one of the kinds of episodes that I hate to do.
How should I be feeling about that?
Well, It's in the sense that I don't have a lot of information about the missing woman we're featuring today.
Okay.
So, like, I have details about, like, what happened to her, but I feel like I can't get a good handle on who she was as a person. And, you know, that's my priority.
Right? Yeah. We haven't covered a story like that in a while, actually.
Right. And so there are very few details about her case. And we've talked about this before, but It's good for us to cover these episodes because it means that her story is not being told elsewhere, and it's important to highlight her case, so.
Right. A lack of information shouldn't be a lack of knowledge, right?
Right. So, yeah, I guess what I'm saying is I'm, like, kind of feeling her like, absence twice in this, like, mm-hmm. her actual disappearance and also kind of her erasure from, like, the news coverage.
Okay.
Yeah, but again, I think people need to hear her name. Her name is Maria Bozzi. And just also, I wanted to tell this story because, like, kind of as it started to unfold, it actually had me questioning my own perspectives of, like, what justice is.
Okay.
Because the court cases that stem from her disappearance are actually still discussed and analyzed today. So she's not talked about specifically.
But her court cases are that unique that they're still...
Yes, like the court cases that derive from this disappearance are, they present some interesting questions about justice.
Okay, I'm curious now.
Yeah, so we're going to get there, but first.
Right, I won't skip ahead.
No skipping ahead. We're going to try to tell her story as completely as possible, given like the minimal information about her.
Okay.
Right. So because of this erasure, we aren't going to be starting off learning about her, but we're going to start off with a man she's going to marry. So by our policy, we're going to refer to him as D. And for this, we have to go all the way back to 1997 in Bogota, Colombia.
So clearly this husband was not a good individual.
No.
Because that's what the, for anyone just listening for the first time, we do initials when it's somebody who's not a good person.
Right. And we do that so that, you know, we don't end up fixating on that person's name and remembering that person's name. I want you to remember Maria Bozzi's name.
D doesn't matter aside from being part of her story.
Yes. And so, unfortunately for this episode, again, we're going to have to follow kind of the progression of his story because that's really the information we have.
Okay.
So we're back in, it's 1997. We're in Colombia. And that's where D, who's a reportedly multi-times divorced American man, meets a Colombian woman named Patricia Milano Gutierrez, and the two dated between 1997 and 1998. But in early 1998, Patricia, she moves to England, and Dee goes and visits her there because they're still in a relationship together. At some point, though, during his time in England, he met Maria Bozzi, and those two started a relationship. Now, Maria was 46 years old. She, in her late 30s, had moved from her native Romania to England. And that's perhaps the full extent of what we know about her history.
Okay, so we usually cover women who go missing in the U.S. Is she going to come back here and go missing here?
Yes. So he's American. She's Romanian, living in the U.K. And they meet in the U.K. And I think all of this does play a role in kind of the lack of coverage of her. So despite having lived and worked in the UK since 1991, there weren't any, like, of those newspaper articles about her past that I would have typically used from, like, the UK, right? When we do a story, I read everything possible. So, for instance, if someone won an award in second grade for penmanship and the newspaper covered it, like, I'm reading it. But even if that person goes missing when they're 90, but, like, Maria doesn't have that kind of coverage in UK papers, definitely not in US papers. I don't read Romanian, so...
Okay, so that's really why there's a lack of information about her, because she's not American.
She's not American. She's not a UK. And
she's not from an English-speaking country.
Yeah. So okay, all those things are likely playing in.
And it's also 90s, right? So
yes, this is late 90s that we're
probably in. Probably a lot less documented on, like, the internet and stuff like that.
Right, right.
Yeah.
So sort of getting back to her relationship with Dee. Now, you might be thinking, wasn't he dating that woman from Colombia?
Yes, but come on. We've talked about people who are all over the place with that.
Right.
Stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. So he was, and he still seemed to be continuing his relationship with Patricia. So, like, despite getting married.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, we're calling him by his initial, so.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Now, like, did Maria know that he was with Patricia? Like, I don't think so. Later, police would theorize that she actually didn't know much about her husband. Like, that in Phoenix, Arizona in 1992, he actually had pleaded guilty to manufacturing counterfeit currency and had served 20 months in prison. Or that this probation was later revoked after he was convicted of selling marijuana. So, like, he'd been involved in some stuff.
Not huge right now, right?
No. And, like, overall, those charges, like, seem pretty mundane. I would argue the counterfeiting situation kind of alludes to some later. But, like, the counterfeiting thing, though, is a felony, which does complicate things in terms of employment and in terms of, like, can you own firearms? It is a felony charge.
Okay.
Despite being, like, kind of like a...
It's like a nonviolent crime. Are we to the point where we're just like, oh, it's nonviolent, so it's okay?
I don't know.
Is that where we are in our lives?
I feel like, you know, my sense of the world is definitely skewed, you know, working on missing persons cases for so long. And I'm like, meh.
You're skewing mine now, though. That's the thing where I'm just like, oh, nobody got hurt.
It was just counterfeiting
money. We're fine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. But I do think the counterfeiting thing kind of alludes to some parts of him that we'll get to in a bit. But
okay.
So whether or not Maria knew this information, you know, the couple does get married in April 1999 at a register office in Greenwich, Southeast London. Now, if this sounds like a whirlwind relationship, it certainly was. And a few weeks after, though, Dee returns to the United States and Maria begins trying to, like, tie up loose ends in the UK so that she can join him in the US. Now, Maria sublet her apartment and then worked through her personal belongings. She sold and stored a number of items and then shipped some of those items to other items to, like, the United States. In preparation for her life in the U.S., she also opened up a U.S. bank account in her name only with Citibank and transferred $120,000 to that account.
So she had $120,000?
Yes.
That's a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so... she's packed away this kind of money, you know, I'm guessing some of it comes from selling her personal items, like that kind of stuff. But she, yeah.
So she's, yeah, she must have been somewhat well off then.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I think Maria is doing pretty good.
Okay.
So after, though, she sublets her apartment, there is this gap of time before she's supposed to leave for the U.S. During that time, she stays with her friend and her ex-boyfriend, Michael. Now, she uses Michael's mailing address for her bank and credit card statements. Remember, like, she's between things. She hasn't, like, established, like, a U.S. presence yet, so she doesn't have an address in the U.S. She's sublet her apartment, so, like, Michael's is, like, the place that her mail will go. So the bank and credit card statements are going there.
Michael's in the UK?
Yep.
Okay.
And yeah, so that's kind of what's going on with her. By the end of July, she was ready to move, though, and Michael drove her to the airport where she took a flight to Nevada. She was supposed to meet her new husband there on July 30th, and we know for the first few days she stayed at the Railroad Pass Hotel, checking out on August 2nd. We also know that she started setting up her new life just like quickly as possible. Like using her funds, she purchased a 1994 Ford Thunderbird, registering that car in her name. She also used her money to buy a $14,000 mobile home. And with this, she leased space for it at the Lakeshore Trailer Village in the Lake Mead National Recreation Area. Like her other transactions, she was the only tenant listed on this lease, and she listed herself as the sole owner of the mobile home as well. It's believed that Maria, along with Dee, moved in on August 30th. Now, again, I couldn't find out much about what kind of life Maria was living in the United States during her month there or what people thought of her, but I did find that the neighbors of the trailer village did have some odd encounters with her husband, Dee. Now, to them, Dee was probably a bit of an enigma. He told various stories about his occupation. He told some of them that he was a crop duster, others that he was a chiropractor, and still others that he was an overseas engineer. And like, I really find it fascinating that this is like such a wide range of answers and that he gave those answers to a really like small number of people.
That's so weird. And what does he do for real? Do we know?
Yeah, no.
Oh, okay.
No.
But not a crop duster or a chiropractor.
No, none of those. Yeah.
So weird.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of reminds me of the girly Chew story that we told, like, when we first started the podcast, right? Like, her husband. He, like,
NASA and a doctor.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All of the things, right?
So weird.
Now, on September 4th, Michael spoke with Maria on the phone. During their conversation, she told him that she and Dee were going on a mini trip and that she thought they'd be back in maybe, like, a week or two. Michael said that she didn't tell him where they were going on the trip, but she did say that she would call when she got back. So he didn't expect to hear from her for a little bit. But on September 11th, Michael got a phone call from a representative at Citibank who was trying to reach Maria. For confidentiality reasons, they could only tell them that this had to do with some checks and that this was an urgent matter. Michael gave them Maria's phone number in the United States, but on the 17th, Citibank froze her account, likely because they were concerned about activity on her account. Realizing that Citibank wasn't getting a hold of Maria, Michael called her and left her a message. And within half an hour, Dee called Michael back and said that Maria had found a job in Vancouver and had gone ahead there.
Wait, is she already missing? Wait, am I getting ahead?
No, you're not getting ahead.
She's already missing.
So she's told Michael she's going on a trip.
And then that's it?
Yeah.
Okay, wow. Okay.
And Michael's like, where is she? And so he calls. Citibank was like, we're concerned about this.
Right.
Right. Yeah. So Michael tries to follow up and he's like, hey, where's Maria? And Dee says, oh, she's gone to Vancouver for a job.
Yeah. I just caught on there. I'm like, thought she was still around a little longer.
No, it happens so quietly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's like one of the creepy things about her case is that it's just like, when you don't have people kind of interacting with you who care about you on a regular basis, that kind of like slip out.
Right. Like we usually talk about like the last time a coworker saw them or the last time a best friend saw them. And we're just getting straight into she's gone.
Yeah. So like, you know, she makes this phone call to Michael, says she's going to be on a trip and she won't call him for like 1 to 2 weeks. And then Citibank is calling him and he's like, well, that's kind of weird. Right.
Michael seems like a good person.
Yeah, I mean, I would want someone like Michael in my life to, like, kind of keep tabs and follow up. So so Michael has no, like, necessary reason not to believe Dee, but, like, it's probably all kind of odd to him because, you know, he and Maria were in regular conversation and she's not told him that she was going to Vancouver. Now, around the same time, Dee told a neighbor named Gracie that Maria had gone back to England.
This guy needs to start taking notes on, like, what he tells people.
I know.
And stick to one story.
The inconsistencies, right?
Yeah.
So, though none of the people who he's telling these things know one another, it establishes that he was telling, like, various different people these different stories, right? Mm-hmm. So, finally, after a few more days, Michael decides he's going to call in a report. So, since the trailer park is located in a national parks area, he ends up reporting this to the United States Park Service. This means it's park ranger Gary Sebade who responds, and on September 29th, Ranger Sebade makes contact with Dee. This is where Dee introduces another story. This time it's that Maria has decided to go back to Romania. Hmm. Now, Later that day, and this is unbeknownst to authorities at the time, Dee actually makes a call to schedule a hernia surgery for himself on October 5th, and he uses Maria's health insurance card and her account number to schedule the surgery under her name, well, under the name Mario Bozzi. So he changes just one letter of Maria's name to make it work. Yeah, I mean, assuming that, like, you could just be like, oh, it was a mistype on the form. It was supposed to be Mario, right? Now, meanwhile, those park rangers must not have felt confident about him saying that Maria was in Romania because it's clear they're keeping an eye on him. On October 1st, rangers were in the park to witness Dee loading some of Maria's things from the trailer into his truck. They followed him to a dumpster, and it's there they saw him throwing some items inside. After he left, they checked the dumpster, and it's there they found something that must have made their blood run cold. In the items they found was a receipt made out to a Dr. David for the purchase of some chloroform.
Huh.
The receipt was dated July 7th, 1999, just a few weeks before Maria landed in Nevada.
It's such a weird, obvious thing to find, right? Like, this is one of those clues you'd find in, like, a cheesy detective movie.
Right? Like,
Who just keeps that receipt and then throws it out whole? Like, I don't know about you, but I'd be tearing it into tiny fragments or burning it.
Right, no, it's just in the dumpster. Yeah.
Yeah.
At this point, sensing that something could have truly happened to Maria, they seized her trailer and just basically, like, wrap it in police tape. I don't know if they were hoping Dee would return to the trailer, but he didn't. Instead, he checked into a motel in Las Vegas. And then, over a week later, on October 9th, Maria's Thunderbird was stolen from the trailer park. Also, officials noted that the tape had been tampered with, indicating that someone had been there.
Okay.
To be clear, at this point, no one has heard from Maria, not Michael, not her mom in Romania, who she was regularly in touch with, not any of her other connections. So, like, nobody's hearing from her. And investigators start to put together an alarming sequence of events in regards to her disappearance. So let's go somewhat behind the scenes of what Dee was recorded as doing after Maria last spoke to her friend Michael on September 4th. We know that Maria had placed $120,000 in that Citibank account, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm assuming this is the same account that she used to purchase, like, the Thunderbird and her mobile home.
Right.
But we also know that Michael was called after Maria's last known date of contact by a Citibank representative hoping to get a hold of Maria. And we also know this account was shut down shortly after for suspicious activities. So that's, we know that, right?
Right.
What investigators are able to uncover is that sometime between September 7th and September 17th, a man wearing a hat, sunglasses, and a fake mustache.
Come on. We can't have a chloroform receipt and a fake mustache in the same story.
Look, he was wearing a fake mustache. He withdrew.
Oh my God.
$8,000 from Maria's Citibank account. Like, obviously, I mean, I don't think I need to point this out that this was Dee.
Well, yeah.
In his fake mustache.
No.
Okay. And then on September 10th, he purchased an $8,000 cashier's check and made this payable to Patricia.
Patricia, the old girlfriend in Colombia?
Yeah. I mean, or current girlfriend?
Wife person?
I mean,
were they married?
They're not married. They're not married. But okay. I mean, he sends her this $800,000.
So they're still a thing?
They're still a thing. Yeah. Okay. I don't think their relationship ever ended.
So. Okay. I guess I kind of, like, put her on a back burner and just assumed that had ended.
Like, no.
No. Okay. No.
So, but this $8,000 withdrawal is for the cashier's check. You know, it's not the only financial transaction. On September 13th, Dee withdrew $40,000 from Maria's account and put it into his own. 4 days after this is when Citibank froze the account. So those are the weird transactions that they were flagging and worried about, right? Now, this brings us to the month of October. This is when investigators found the receipt for the chloroform and then promptly wrapped Maria's trailer in police tape. In October, Dee, we now know, he's been documented to have been up to a few things. One is that a woman named Lorinda would She'd later say that Dee tried to sell her some of Maria's personal items, like in clothing and shoes. Dee told her that his wife had left him, which is why he was getting rid of them. In October, Dee also attempted to use Maria's credit card to purchase $5,000 in synthetic emeralds over the internet.
What?
I didn't even know about why? Synthetic emeralds, but...
And it's still $5,000 on fake emeralds?
Yeah.
Why?
I don't know.
I want to know.
I don't know.
If somebody knows why somebody would do this, please contact me.
Do you see one a personal message?
I want to know why.
Right. Okay. Thankfully, in this transaction, her card is actually declined. I'm assuming at this point, like, there's been, like, locks on her account. But these transactions and interactions weren't the only thing Dee was up to. He'd taken a motel room while in Las Vegas, and while there, he met a guy named David Lee Krause. Dee convinces David that he's a Secret Service agent, and he offers David $1,000 if he could have use of David's identifying information.
Please tell me David didn't agree to this.
David agreed to it. And David! I'm not sure why, but it happened.
No, David.
Yeah.
This is craziness. Okay, we've got a fake mustache. We've got a chloroform receipt. We've got...
Synthetic emeralds.
Synthetic emeralds, and now we are buying somebody, yeah, we're in the Secret Service and we're buying service and we're buying someone's identifying information. Mm-hmm. Where are we getting our like criminal, we have like a criminal activity guidebook here. We're just checking things off.
Vanessa.
What?
Okay, I always tell you stop getting ahead, but yes.
No, you're being ridiculous right now. You're joking.
No.
He had like a handbook?
Mm-hmm.
Oh my. Okay. I need to just shut up and keep listening.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Now, again, I am not sure why David agrees to this, but again, he's promised $1,000. He's told he's a Secret Service agent, but he does later say that Dee actually stiffed him and he only got $200 for it. Now, Dee is able to use David's information to obtain a Utah's driver's license and then a United States passport under the name David Lee Krause. And to be clear, this works so well that these documents, though having David's personal information, have Dee's picture. So, like, these appear or would appear to anyone who saw them as, like, authentic documents.
Mm. We'll be back in a moment.
Now, these documents actually allowed Dee to leave the United States under the name David Lee Krause in November. And where does he go? Straight back to the UK. And once there, under that name, he marries Patricia.
Okay. And so Patricia's got to be aware that he's using a different name now?
I mean, they get married under that name, so...
Patricia, David, come on, people.
Right. Yeah. So I'm guessing, like, you know, at this point, things are going pretty smoothly. Like, he's got this well, in terms of he was able to obtain official documents, he was able to use them. He was also able to use them to get married.
Yeah. Anyway, yes, I guess we can consider that successful.
You know, in terms of, in some regard.
The guidebook is working.
In some ways.
Yes. Yeah.
No. Okay. Okay. Now... he's probably pretty, like, feeling pretty confident. He's able to access funds. He's gotten himself a new identity, and he's been able to travel and marry with these documents, right? So it's probably not surprising that he also feels really comfortable enough to, like, return to the United States using this same passport on February 7th, 2000. Mm-hmm. Now, the next day, Henderson police, so these are Nevada's based police, they pull over a 1994 Thunderbird whose driver is speeding. Inside is a man who identified himself as David Lee Krause. Hmm. But when police run the license plate, they see that this plate is connected to Maria Bosey. Now, it seems at this point that this is enough for the Henderson police to dig deeper and they contact the FBI. The FBI asks for Dee to be detained until federal agents could be contacted and arrive. So this, combined with some reportedly outstanding warrants, is enough to place Dee under arrest. Now, this arrest triggers a full FBI investigation, which lasts between February 8th, the day of Dee's arrest, through February 25th. During the course of this investigation, they learned that, you know, that Dee had married Patricia in England under this assumed identity, and their attempts to locate her are unsuccessful. They begin to fear the worst, that they have actually two women missing.
Do they?
No, it takes them a while, but they are actually able to locate her. Okay. She's still alive. And that means, like, U.S. Attorney Gregory Dam makes a public statement and he says, "I'm very pleased wife number two is safe, but that doesn't relieve any concerns I have about wife number one." The investigation continues and it culminates in a search of various locations on February 28th. In this, they search Maria's mobile home, a fifth wheel trailer, three vehicles, one of which I believe is the Thunderbird, as well as some storage units. Now, okay, what they find is kind of unsettling. They find some weapons, guns specifically. Now, Dee is a convicted felon, so he shouldn't have been in possession of these guns. They also find a briefcase with an assortment of documents, some of which have Maria's name on it, and they also find some papers where it looks like her signature is being copied, or like that someone's practicing her signature. Yeah. But this is probably one of the more upsetting finds. Maria's passport is reportedly in one of the storage units. So all of those stories that she's in Vancouver or England or Romania, well, like now they're definitely not true. And like, yeah, you know, what people suspected probably long before this is that she was not in any of those locations. But this kind of is just like the takes away that last hope, right?
I find it funny that the guidebook didn't tell him to burn that stuff.
Yeah. My God, this guy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
But what is more shocking is in his possession is a collection of books. Now, there is a joke among writers, of which I am one, and really amongst the mystery writers I know, that is like basically like if something happens and the police look at my search history, I need them to know that this was for research. Right.
We've talked about this before.
Yeah. Like, don't look at my search history. That doesn't mean anything. Yeah. So, like, working on this podcast, I research so many different topics, right? Like, that I could, yeah. Mm-hmm. And also, I have a personal library. And, like, to qualify as having a personal library, you have to have at least 1,000 books. And I haven't logged all of them yet because I don't have the patience, but, like, I easily have at least 1,000 books in my house. And I have to say, a good number of them are on some gruesome topics.
Mm-hmm.
But none of them are quite in the same vein as the books that Dee had.
I'm curious.
Like, okay.
I'm so curious.
Like, there's what you are expecting. Like, somewhat tame ones about how to change your identity or how to get a new identity.
Okay.
But there are also ones like Pipe and Firebomb Designs or The Revenge Encyclopedia or books on the principles of military interrogation, or a book titled Hitman, a Technical Manual.
These are really subtle names.
Yeah. Wouldn't be able to guess at all.
Not obvious at all.
Now, or one titled The Death Dealer's Manual, or another one, Dragon's Touch, Weaknesses of Human Anatomy. Right.
What?
Yeah. Like, these are not the kind of books that you are going to be seeing, like, casually displayed on a bookshelf, you know? And, like, I know that we are kind of laughing about this because I just
think it's, like, it's just absurd. I'm laughing at the absurdity of it.
Of, like, that these books exist and, like, this man is, like, yeah.
Right. You're right. It's not a funny topic, but it is a funny concept.
Right.
Yes. Yeah.
And, like,
but, like, these aren't coffee table books.
No. And just, like, they're not, like, there are books that you can buy at a bookstore, and there's books that you have to buy.
You have to seek them out somewhere,
you have to
right?
seek them out, right? So yeah. He has sought out really, like, a large collection of these books.
Right. And, I mean, we know these books are around. I'm sure, like, I'm from the generation of, like, the anarchist cookbook and right, stuff right, like right. that. So there's some, like, mainstream ones that we know about and stuff yeah. like that. But those were kind of, like, I don't know if anyone ever bought those seriously.
Mm-hmm.
It was just something to page through as a teenager to look cool or feel cool.
Right.
But this is like, he is actually studying up.
Yeah. Like Hitman, a Technical Manual.
Right.
It really hits home, I think, like seeing that, like, Maria meeting this man and then suddenly she's like moving in with him. Meanwhile, he has like this large collection of books that she like likely never
even... No, she doesn't know, right?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It's just like,
yes. How you can think you know someone and there's all this.
Right. Going on.
It's scary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, again, I need to make clear that there is little news coverage about Maria's disappearance. And most of this coverage does focus on Dee. This does little to help us see Maria as a person. But it does let us see, like, what type of situation mm-hmm. she found herself in being married to him, right? Like,
oof. Yeah.
Now, one of the people interviewed at this time is Dee's parents. And again, yes, this does focus on him, but again, it helps us see what is going on, right? And how Maria, like, got taken in. Now, his father specifically is the one who talks to the press. Like, he and his wife had thought Dee was working on an oil rig off the coast of the Netherlands.
So they don't even know the truth.
No, they think he's an oil rig worker.
Okay.
So, yeah. Again, he didn't work on a rig, and they did not know that he'd been spending the last few months going back and forth between England. His parents weren't even aware that he'd gotten married once, let alone twice, in the past few months, right? But this news doesn't surprise his father, only the fact that he's a suspect in a missing persons case. In all, it's apparent that Dee is not in close contact with his parents. They last heard from him around Christmas time, so roughly a month before, and even that was just a Christmas card. Before that, they'd last physically seen him in July 1998. Dee's father said that Dee had stayed with them for a bit before going back to his offshore oil rig job, the non-existent job. Mm-hmm. And from there, his dad thought his son worked about like a month on the rig and then would like take time off for a few weeks. And he thought his son would spend those few weeks in England, right? When reporters seemed to tell Dee's dad that there was no oil rig job, he said, "It doesn't surprise me. He hasn't told us the truth in a long time." During this interview, he also revealed that Dee had been married before. His dad said he thought it was at least three times, and he also thought that Dee had as many as five children.
What?
Yeah. When he was asked about using false identities, his dad said that he assumed that his son would be doing that to avoid paying child support.
Okay.
When asked if he planned on getting in touch with his son, his dad said no. He said, "There are spells where we think he's changing his ways, and then there are times where we give up on him. He's a hard worker when he's around, but you can't rely on anything he says."
It's sad that they know this. Like,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
It seems like word from his parents would have been helpful.
Yeah.
At the beginning. Like if they would have been able to know these girls that he's marrying, these women.
Yeah, but like he's not telling his parents the truth about his life, right? Like they think he's on an oil rig, right? Yeah. Now, by July 2000, so mere months after he was arrested, Dee actually pleaded guilty to 10 counts of having to do primarily with the firearms charges, as well as charges regarding the false documents that he took out under Krause's name. Prior to sentencing for these charges, Dee's defense lawyer, Arthur Allen, says of Maria's disappearance and his client's potential involvement, "Mr. Fitch's position is that he is as puzzled as everyone else by her disappearance. I have told them in court that if they think she was murdered, they should file charges to see them back up their claims." These charges are not filed. But that November, he's sentenced for the crimes he pleaded guilty to, the firearms and the David Krause stuff, right? This nets him actually a substantial amount of jail time, which is 97 months worth, which is a little over 8 years.
That's pretty good compared to some of the things we talk about.
Yeah, so 8 years for that. But in June 2004, so this is a substantial amount of time later, he's indicted on additional charges. This time he's facing charges related to the use of Maria's accounts. The list is quite lengthy, but it's 9 counts of bank fraud, 2 counts of fraudulent use of an access device, 2 counts of attempted fraudulent use of an access device, 2 counts of laundering monetary instruments, and 1 count of money laundering. So
it's a lot of charges.
Yeah, it's 16 total.
Ooh.
Yeah. This time the case goes to trial, and there's a lot of push and pull happening between the attorneys here. The prosecutors essentially allege that Dee married Maria specifically with the intent of killing her and stealing her property, that his goal was to have a life with Patricia and to use Maria's money to fund it. And when he's found guilty, the judge seems to agree with this presentation, which is, yeah, that this is what happened. Yeah. Now, the sentencing recommendations for these crimes he's been convicted of typically would have carried a 41 to 51 month sentence total. So between 3.5 to a little over 4-ish years. But the judge sentences him to 262 months, which is over 21 years. That's six times the amount.
Huh. Do we know why?
Well, yeah. So in his statement, the judge essentially says that he, the judge, doesn't believe that these financial crimes could have been conducted without Maria's murder.
Okay.
Yeah.
So he's kind of rolling that in there.
Yeah, he's taking this into consideration. So in the government sentencing memorandum in regards to this case, it stated that there was an elaborate and lengthy plan to marry Maria, lure her to the U.S., where she would be isolated from friends and family, and then take her possessions, which included her bank funds. And so what ends up happening is this, like, huge upward movement from the typical sentencing guidelines. And this is something that has legal experts and scholars, like, still discussing this case today. It's also what gets this landed in front of a U.S. Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in 2011. Now, this isn't like a regular jury trial. Instead, three judges who hear these cases, they decide what they're going to do with them. And in this case, it's a 2-1 decision in favor of upholding the 262-month sentencing. Essentially, and I'm not a legal expert, what they end up saying is that it's within the judge's purview to take into consideration things like that the jury might not be able to hear or know about during the sentencing and use this in their sentencing decision. Judge Mahan said that he based his stiffer sentence on different factors, such as the fact that Dee never reported the disappearance to the police, and that he told different stories about where his wife was, and also he tried to sell her personal effects, including her car. He also said that it was because Dee remarried shortly after the disappearance without getting divorced, that he had her checkbook and credit cards in his possession, and that he raided her bank accounts using disguises or forgery, and those were all indications to him, you know, that Maria was murdered. So this is what the original judge is able to, like, take into consideration.
Which he's not wrong on.
Yeah. So, like, this is where I'm like, oh.
Right. Mm. He's now making something happen without having all the pieces.
Yeah, but, like, so
essentially, what, I don't know.
I know. This is where it gets sticky. So, like, this is where, like, the one dissenter in the circuit court decision. So this is Judge Alfred Goodwin. He basically says that there was no clear and convincing evidence to show that a murder was committed in connection to the fraud. So he says, like, hey, during this trial, like, the trial itself did not prove that a murder happened.
Right. And we never found, like, normally, sometimes when we talk about it, we don't have a body still, but we found, like, a huge quantity of blood, or we found something else, you know?
Yeah.
We're not finding that, are we?
Yeah. So this is, like, why this, like,
have
again,
we found any blood? Like, have we found anything?
No. So, like, the assumption is that he murdered her, but this was not brought up in jail. Like, this is where it, like, challenges my assumption of what, like, justice looks like. And it has less to do with Dee himself. Like, I'm not, like, obviously this is the case we're talking about. Like, but, like, collectively, like, what does this mean in broader terms?
Right, because what if this was a case where she got, like, really intimidated by him and then ran back to Romania?
Right.
And then is hiding there because she's afraid of him.
And again, I'm not saying that that's what happened. You're not saying
what I'm not saying that's what happened. But it's just like there's always that, like, possibility or that doubt because we don't have a body and we don't have any quantity of anything that would indicate death.
Yeah. And so, like, what this one circuit court judge is saying is, like, hey, we did not prove in a court of law that a murder.
But then on the other hand, aren't you kind of like, yes, good job, judge.
Yeah. Like,
right. It is like a moral gray spot here.
Yeah.
Where you want justice to happen no matter what, but is this truly justice?
Yeah. Like, so, like, because it's
so
just
I get,
like,
what you're saying now.
Yeah. Because it's like Dee didn't actually go on trial for murder. He went on trial for these, like, financial crimes. Yeah. Right? If he had gone to trial for murder, the prosecutors would have actually had to prove their case, right?
Okay.
So, like, we even know, like, Maria's body has not been found, but we know cases that will move forward without a body, right? And there are plenty of murder convictions without body cases. Like, we've covered them here,
right?
Like, we even covered, you know, like, one of the first ones in this, like, podcast. Mm-hmm. Like, but that's not what they did. Like, the trial itself didn't set out to prove her murder. It simply presented the evidence about the financial transactions. So I do see this as, like, an extremely inflated sentence. And I think I do see it as an overstep by the judge. Because, like, something that wasn't proven in the court of law, meaning the murder, was used to inflate a sentence simply because the judge believed that that's the progression of events, essentially. And again, my concern is less about Dee himself, right? But more about how this is used or could be used in other cases.
Right, because you're thinking of the bigger picture, where I think I'm coming from like an emotional place where I'm like, good job, judge.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think we both see completely, like I said, that gray area.
Mm-hmm.
But you're leaning to one side because you don't want this to happen to other people in the future or like other people right. that have the same thing. And then I'm just looking at this one individual case and feeling like the gut thing feels like this is the right
Yeah, and I do move. Have that like same gut thing too, right?
Do you?
Because like I want there to be justice for
Maria.
But also, and I think it's also because I do so much like other thought and work in like the wrongful conviction right. space.
So that's what I was thinking too when we were.
Yeah. Like, so for instance, like if someone was accused of stealing a car and they were like convicted for it, right? And like the judge says, hey, the only way you could have stolen that car is if you like killed the owner.
Right.
Like.
Right. But on this one, like. Individually, we have like all those lies about her whereabouts. We have him taking her money. Mm-hmm. We have a fake mustache. We have all these books.
Yeah.
So it's just, he's not good. But we haven't proven anything, so.
Yeah. And so, like, I agree, he is not good. And do my personal suspicions rest in one area? Yeah, but like.
But it's not a personal thing,
like
right?
The feeling isn't the same as like the proof. Right?
Well, law shouldn't be based on emotions or feelings.
Yeah.
So that's the thing too, right? We have to go with facts and proof.
Yeah, and I guess this is why it's like, oh my God, I was sitting with this case and I was like.
Going back and forth like, good job, wait, no, good job, wait, but wait, like, good job.
But like, wait, like yeah. How do I feel like if this is applied
right.
generally, right? Like, yeah.
Huh.
Like, do I think something terrible happened to Maria?
Yes.
Probably, yeah. Yeah. Like, am I expressing like all these feelings on Dee's behalf? No. But in terms of that bigger picture, like, does this all give me, like, pause? Like, absolutely.
Yeah.
Like, what does that mean more broadly?
Mm-hmm.
Right. So now, unsurprisingly to most, it has actually now been 25 years since Dee entered prison. So if you did the math.
That's more than he was.
Yeah. And it's been so long that he's actually been released. And his time out of prison seems to have been short-lived. And he's now back in for other crimes in Texas. So, yeah.
He's just not staying out.
No. Now, I want to bring it back to Maria.
Mm-hmm.
Because, like, so little of this episode was able to focus on her. And we're going to go to the FBI special agent on this case, Henry Schlumpf. And he was asked by the media for a response after Dee was convicted. He'd been assigned to the case shortly after Maria was reported missing. And Special Agent Schlumpf said, kind of the ultimate goal in any homicide investigation is to find the body and find closure for the family. And we haven't done that yet. We'll always be looking.
We are now going to listen to Amy's poem, A Testimony, read by Anne Pervu. Anne is a Romanian-Canadian actress and producer from Toronto, Ontario. She is best known for her roles in the television series Rain, Remedy, and The Girlfriend Experience. She is currently portraying the role of Trish on the television series Working Moms.
A Testimony. Maria Bozzi, 46, missing since September 1st, 1999, from Boulder City, Nevada. Believe me, my darling, the light will leak across the sky into the airplane cabin, streaking your world with warning, a cry you won't hear. From below, perhaps I watched you heading west, your plane pulling across all that blue, just a lonely guest waiting here, gathering these words in my chest to testify. In Romania, the flowers are still blooming, a lullaby of color, a riot of petals fluttering in the wind, while a dragonfly lights on an outstretched finger. This is where I find your protest, believe me, my darling. But in truth, we will keep losing you. Only in my mind's eye, the cold, clear waters of Lake Mead washing over you like a reply and the cicadas picking up their racket, their own bodies obsessed with the song of life or death, as though they were joining our outcry.
For more information about our show or to check out other shows on the network, please visit evergreenpodcast.com. Bye, Vanessa.
Bye, Amy.
Until now, the data your AI depends on has been trapped behind ever-increasing cloud fees. Wasabi created Hut Cloud Storage and is redefining cloud storage for the AI era, delivering simple, predictable cloud storage for AI, analytics, media, and more. Your data is free to move, fast to access, and ready when your AI needs it. Hidden fees add up fast as AI workloads grow. Wasabi's flat pricing eliminates all of it. One rate, no surprises. Learn more and try now for free at wasabi.com. Wasabi, the AI storage cloud. Proud partner of the iHeart Podcast Network.
Moro Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.